Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel and Jumper and Comic Extension. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
Chris Cassot.
Hello.
And Cole Hornaday.
Hey.
Hey, how is everybody this cold evening?
Cold.
Cool.
We're warm in
it
here.
Yeah, it is actually rather pleasant in the store, I will say.
But as soon as we get outside, the safe comfort of Comics Dungeon, we're gonna freeze our sweet bippies.
In case you're not listening, maybe the cold has lifted by the time this airs, but it's dry but cold. It's like 20 degrees now. If anybody is listening to us from like the Midwest, where it routinely gets colder than Mars, literally, I read that.
Are you serious?
There was a cold snap where like most of the Midwest was like at 5 degrees Fahrenheit or below, and that 5 degrees I think is like Martian average temperature or something. Having not been to Mars, I can't tell you, but for
having
Seattle
been to Wisconsin,
it's really cold.
I truly believe that.
All of my Midwest friends are laughing at me like, this is nothing,
but when you're used to these moderate winters.
It has been over 20 years since I lived in Wisconsin, but walking in my car from my office, I am quickly uncomfortable. Yeah.
Hairs freeze.
Well, that's how I know I'm channeling my experience. And Ben and I, we have lush forests.
I was
in our nasal cavities.
Like, I was. I'm so glad you brought that
so
up.
So much information.
I was walking home and I saw a dude wearing like a t-shirt and cargo shorts, and I'm like, you're not impressing anybody,
fella. There's always those guys.
Yeah.
People just think you're a moron.
But when I lived in Madison, they did that. As soon as the sun came out, there'd be permafrost on the ground, pigeons dropping out of the sky encased in ice, and here are these clowns walking along in their cargo shorts and their high tops.
New York, where I lived, they would pull out their Birkenstocks again and wear their cargo shorts, but then they'd wear their North Face puffy jacket.
Yeah. I just
people are weird.
Yeah.
I was gonna say bad things. I'm not going to.
Don't say bad things. Anyway, hey friends, I am springing a topic on you. A bit of a small one, not very long, but because I just thought about this as we were recording the last episode. Cole brought out a bunch of these comics, a bunch of Flintstones, a bunch of other ones that are already bagged and boarded. I've begun to acquire some singles. I'm mostly into the trades because I think they look better on the shelf.
Yeah.
But I have a few singles as well. Is the rationale to bag and board every single thing, every single single that you own?
Depends on you.
Depends on me?
Yeah, just because some people will, no matter what. They'll bag everything.
Some people just bag them, and some people don't bag them at all.
And some people will just like, well, I know I'm going to read this, but my child's going to destroy this other one, so I'm not going to buy that bag and board. You know, so just depends on your personal needs and what you want to preserve just a little bit longer.
Yeah.
I have gone back and rebagged and boarded a lot of my older comics that I'm particularly fond of.
Right.
Because one thing Chris pointed out to me a couple of years ago was they just look nicer
they're
in their nice and you know, no matter how hard we try, we're still collecting dust.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all going to turn to powder eventually. But I have, you know, but there were comics in from the Bronze Age and earlier that they are definitely leaching out the acids and stuff like that. You take them out of the bags, or at least I'm taking them out of the bags, and those bags are yellow.
Yeah.
You know, they look like the comic books have been smoking, you know?
Yeah. What have you been doing while I've been gone?
Yeah.
Comics shouldn't smoke.
Yeah.
It's bad.
And they look nicer, and even though they're a little, you know, maybe they're in fair condition, but boy, they look a lot nicer when you stick them in a bag, in a fresh bag, with a fresh board.
It's like a new pair of underpants.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's nice. And
I don't think I have anything that is going to be escalating in value too much. I have like the Descenders series one and Mad Max and some other ones. I got those Weird Science ones you gave me.
Yep. Those are research, though.
That's research.
That's research
that's
for
a tax
future
write-off.
That's for a future episode of the Panel Jumper.
All right. Anyway, friends, let's move on. And this is a topic I basically just straight up stole from the internet. So thanks, internet. Let's pretend I really got into Doctor Doom. What are some of his best stories?
Take it away, Chris.
You don't have to pretend. He's easy to get into. So it's, if you don't want to go back and reread the classic Jack Kirby, Stan Lee stuff, but you do want to get like an introduction to the origin of Dr. Doom, I would recommend Ed Brubaker's Books of Doom. That's where he kind of, he stayed pretty true to the original content, but he kind of did a modernization element of just kind of making it a little bit darker in the background, showing you as how he got corrupted and messed around with his own government and everything like that. But it,
before or after the armor? Where does it start?
It starts before, and it starts like from youth, and it shows parent, his mother, and the
do
gypsy
we do the whole
background.
Gypsy? Okay, we do the magic,
all
and
that stuff. Okay. And it ends in fairly modernesque times.
Okay,
But it just kind of depends. There's so many different styles of stories. Like one of my favorites, I will always recommend is there's a standalone graphic novel of Doctor Strange and Doctor Doom called Triumph and Torment by Roger Stern and drawn by
Mike Mangold,
your favorites. Yeah,
it is actually one of my favorite books that he did.
And it's a story of because Doctor Doom's mother sold her soul to Mephisto, the demon. And so Dr. Doom wants to free his mother's soul. So he gets Dr. Strange to help him, and they trek through hell to save his mother's soul. Because Dr. Doom's one of those multi-layered characters of he's pretty honorable most of the time. And he does have empathy, and he does care about things. He cares about his people with an iron fist. But then he flips into those very, very dark stories. And there's one I did really enjoy by Mark Waid and Mike Rowingo, who sadly did pass away, and I really do love his art style, called Unthinkable. And it's when Dr. Doom went all out in his attempt to really kill the hell out of Reed Richards. And that included selling the soul of his beloved, his first beloved relationship to demons, and then wearing her skin as armor.
Oh, jeez.
And then sending Reed Richards' son to hell, and then also a lot of other bad things.
Mm-hmm.
That started in Fantastic Four, Volume 3, Number 66 through Number 70.
It was like Hellraiser, Dr. Doom.
It was Hellraiser, really Dr. Doom. Yeah. It was pretty grim, but there was some actual, like, really good villain moments throughout it. The original Secret Wars, I'll always recommend that, because that's when Dr. Doom got, like, vaporized by a god, and he willed his own existence back together molecule by molecule, which is such a cool idea that Mark Millar stole it and did his run of Fantastic Four. And then the new Secret Wars was actually a really good story. There was just too much stuff that took too long in it, but it was a great Dr. Doom Reed Richards story.
When was the original Secret Wars?
1984?
Like early to mid-80s?
Yeah, mid-80s. Okay. Yeah. And another oddball one is, it's a little tricky to find now because Marvel and DC do not like to reprint it because they don't like to share printings, but Superman and Spider-Man from 1981 was, Jim Shooter wrote it with Marv Wolfman, and it was, they basically were like, well, what villain do we have at Marvel that is the equivalent of for Superman? They were like, Dr. Doom. That's the biggest guy we got. And they told a really, really fun story that had some political stuff in it too, which was great because Dr. Doom couldn't really stand up to Superman for too long, so he just ran back to his embassy and went neener, neener, neener in front of Superman. And because Superman's a Boy Scout, he was just like, dang it, I can't touch him anymore.
Gosh darn it.
Yeah.
Diplomatic immunity.
Yep. And then there's always the first appearance of Squirrel Girl, where she fought Dr. Doom, which
is
always great. And she beat him. It was drawn by Steve Ditko, co-written by Steve Ditko. It counts.
That's right. Yeah. We mentioned that. That was like the JLA? Is that what that was? No, we talked about it on one of the Ask the Panel Jumper videos, where you mentioned Squirrel Girl beat Dr. Doom.
Yeah. You were thinking GLA, Great Lakes.
GLA. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. GLA is Justice League America. So.
And a new Squirrel
Girl. Wrong publisher. No. Different publisher.
The new Squirrel Girl comics actually revisit that, and she meets a time-traveling Dr. Doom from his past before he met her, and she has to deal with him, and he is very much a brilliant threat, and they deal with that. He actually made his own computer coding technology that's all Doom. Like, it's I don't know computer science, but it's, you know, kind of like Morse code if you replaced everything with the word Doom. It says, and so he created a whole computer coding thing based on his name, which was brilliant. But she defeated him through the power of friendship because, you know, other people know proper computer science, which doesn't use the word Doom, and they were able to figure that out. So, yes. Scroll Girl and Dr. Doom have a great relationship.
Excellent. Anybody else got any Dr. Doom stories?
Oh, I just, like, knew this was a Chris episode, so I just let him take it away. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's his guy.
That's my guy.
That's your guy.
Yeah.
All right. So, great. Well, thanks, Chris. I may or may not check out some of those stories.
Oh, just
in
do it. Quit being so coy.
Hypothetical question that I posed.
Non-committal response.
I hate it when you're coy.
All right. So, this next segment is something that I came up with. It's called Defend It. Mm. And you guys had a chance to submit other comics for me. Maybe I'll ask you if you have other things you want to defend. But what I want to bring up to you, panel, is I know that every single one of you have certain titles that you just don't like, you don't care for. And so in this coming new year, I want us to look at the thing, look at some things, and like try to find the positive in them. And it also comes out of this this movie series that happens at the Central Cinema here in Seattle, where we take a bad movie and a stand-up comedian or some other performer has to prosecute it, and the other one has to defend it. Mm. And the audience is the jury, and they decide if the movie lives or dies. I don't know. I've never been, so I don't know if they like condemn it to die if it loses. Mm. But so I want you to defend a book that is on trial because you don't like it.
Well, it's a book, just to clarify, it's a book that has been established on the podcast that we don't like.
Well, see, that was the original.
Because I have such a big mouth.
That was the original intent, because that's what I know. I don't know that you secretly don't like something else, right? But
no,
I do know that you call
you
her
know
today,
what I don't
do
like.
Not like.
I am
Crossed.
Pretty darn
all right.
passionate about that which I don't like.
Okay, so now I want you to look inward, and I want you to just find the light. Tell me something good. Defend Crossed.
You're going to really regret this.
Well, at least you prepared something.
I did. How much time do we have?
We're still fresh as daisies cold.
I wrote an essay. So.
Well, just for those who don't know, Cross is a comic book written by Irishman Garth Ennis and originally drawn by Jason Burroughs. It was the first 10 issues were published... their original arc was 10 issues. It was published by Avatar starting in 2008. And the story follows the survivors dealing with a pandemic that causes victims to carry out their most evil thoughts. The carriers of the virus, known as the Crossed, due to this rash that appears on their forehead, that easily identifies them as the bad guys, which I think is really clever. This contagion is primarily spread through bodily fluids, which is... not quite groundbreaking, but it's getting there. Which the Crossed have used to great effect by treating their weapons with the bodily fluids, as well as through other forms of direct fluidic contact, such as rape and bites, and assuming that the victim lives long enough to turn. Oh my God! There's gore. There's evisceration. There's dismemberment. It is so much fun. It is so much fun, you guys. But truth be told, the comic's original creator Garth Ennis never intended it to last as long as it did. He was frankly shocked by its appeal, and he didn't expect it to run longer than 10
just
issues.
Just because you do it with like a Valley Girl doesn't mean you're actually defending it.
You are absolutely right.
And for those of you who can see, Cole's kind of frothing at the mouth a little here.
And there's a rash forming on his forehead.
To be honest, said Mr. Ennis, there was never really going to be a volume 2, but apparently the editors over there at in their infinite wisdom at Avatar convinced him that there was money to be made in telling more stories of this nature. I think you kind of get my point, but I want to get to the bottom line of the argument. For my part, the value of the Romero-style zombie tale is this conceit. There is little more frightening than struggling to outthink something that has no brain. And the fear aspect of Cross is that you are dealing with these uber-violent, these uber-violent creatures who, you know, actually can think but are driven to, torture, rape, eviscerate, cannibalize, and all of those kind of fun things. So, you know, I highly recommend Cross to any listeners who have lost all faith in humanity and the positive in any positive potential that we have as human beings, and crave the catharsis only sequential storytelling that peels the most basal and violent characteristics of human nature can supply you. It will be fun. And that is the best I can do to endorse that book, you guys.
Wow.
The best I can do.
You used fun like 3 times.
Thank you, Cole.
Actually, well, I had a 3-page diatribe that I cut short, trust me.
Can you say, though, that at least Jason Burroughs is a competent draftsman?
I think, you know, I used to not like him that much. I used to think he was kind of just pallid. But looking at his artwork in the Moore books, like in The Courtyard and the Neonomicon, and particularly Providence, I think, yeah, he's quite good. Mm. But no, I have no recollection of his work on that book because it really did. Guys, the scene where they imply that they've raped a child was it for me. That was it. Well, I'm not gonna stomach this anymore. We're done. Don't need it. Thanks. Hornaday out.
Hornaday out. All right. Forgot about the baby ripping.
Yeah,
scene.
Yeah. That was it for me.
All right, and on that cheery note, Nicole, I gave you Jessica Jones.
Nothing about this is cheery. No.
because we had a discussion where you don't like Jessica Jones, and Cole likes Jessica Jones, mm-hmm. and so you guys had a bit of a discussion. But I want you to defend Jessica Jones.
Yeah. I didn't do the background of what Jessica Jones was, but since we've talked about her a couple of times now, hopefully you'll know what she is. So for Jessica Jones, I find that she's a different character for the masses that we do not generally see, especially with female characters. While we have a lot of diverse male roles, whether good or bad, a lot of times women have to be this somewhat upholding, integral person. And if they're not, you know, it's not really a good representation. A lot of women have been seen in a slanderous light throughout media. And in Jessica Jones, she is an unapologetic, hard-hitting female protagonist that I feel is a breath of fresh air to just be able to have a woman be very flawed and completely own that she is that way. And I think it speaks to a lot of women to be able to see that diversity, not necessarily in a good light, but just like, oh, look, how refreshing. She doesn't have to be a good girl, or she doesn't have to be a femme fatale. She can be something totally different in her own way. And another thing is that she's been in and out of an interracial relationship. That's something that even still today has a stigma on it. And to also use that as a way to show that there's just any other relationship, it doesn't also have to be in this golden light. It just gives a certain diversity to the range that a female character can be, and also to a range of just like, hey, look, it doesn't matter what race you are, what gender you are, any of that stuff. People have relationships that win and fail all the time. So why not show this character this way? Mm-hmm. So that's my defense of Jessica.
Cool. Excellent.
All right.
Nice job.
Thank you, Nicole.
Yeah.
And Chris, now I gave you Civil War because one day I asked, what's a book you hate? I'm going to read that.
Yep.
And you gave me Civil War. So, Chris, defend Civil War.
I can only do it by bits and pieces. So I can break up and say, like, Steve McNiven's art is pretty nice throughout it. And there are certain moments throughout the story that have an entertaining element to them. There's a sequence towards the end that I remember where during the big brawl with everybody, Spider-Man is doing the most Spider-Man-y Spider-Man stuff he is by jumping around. And McNiven's art really captures it, where not a single person on not his side, because I can't remember, he flips sides all the time, was trying to tag him and they couldn't get him. And Mr. Fantastic like pauses and just goes, amazing. And then he gets a kick to the face. And that's a great moment because Reed Richards is kind of a D-bag. And seeing him get kicked in the face by Spider-Man, not a bad thing. There's a great sequence where Hercules, who's really, really pissed off that they cloned Thor and made him into a robot killing machine, where he's just like, I've had all I can stands and I can't stands no more. And he just rips that clone's head off. Just like, yeah, that's a good reaction to that. But otherwise, I mean, I guess I could say it did influence the setup for the Captain America Civil War movie, which is significantly more entertaining. Mm-hmm. So there's that. That's a positive. But even in the long term, it just did more horrible things for me. So there's goodness within it. But I have some problems. And its existence caused other things to be better because Straczynski, J. Michael Straczynski, was so just pissed off because they kept on forcing all these core things into his books because Spider-Man was important to Civil War. He was writing Spider-Man. The Fantastic Four were kind of important, so he was writing that. And so he had to improve on these bad plot decisions by Mark Millar and make him worthwhile. He had to try and make Reed Richards not a D-bag over in the main title. And he also had a fun thing where he had Ben Grimm being like, I'm not picking any sides, I'm going to France. And then in the Spider-Man title, he had his work cut out for him because he had to try and amend Spider-Man flip-flopping on both sides and also Peter revealing his identity. So he did much more entertaining job over there. And so as a trickle-down effect, there's good things that came out of it.
And as a result, didn't he like leave Marvel in a huff after that? Was that another situation?
I thought it was due to the Thor situation.
Okay.
Which was a bit later.
Yeah.
So and that's a thing you could take as a positive or a negative that he left. For me, it's a little bit of a positive. I felt like he kind of ran his course.
Got it.
He had a lot of good things in there, but yeah. So yeah, I guess that kind of defends it.
All right. Well, thank you all for your testimony. The jury is going to step out and deliberate. And while they do, let's move on to book report, everybody. And Nicole, let's start with you this week. What do you want to talk about?
My brain went all the way to quiz time. I was like, what? I'm not quiz time. Okay. All right. This is the last of our recording tonight. So my brain is working. I am going to review Gumballs number one by Aaron Nations. It is a journalistic style approach to a comic book, and it is all written and drawn by them. It's mostly journaling their process with coming to terms with being trans, with also just being out in the world, being out to their parents, and in between there's these little made-up stories, as far as I know, about these different dating woes of Tobias, who's this very awkward, nerdy person. And it's pretty cute. I really enjoyed it. It's definitely a very, very, very indie tale. The art is very clean and simplistic. Everyone's very boxy. I described to someone today, it's kind of like a more indie version of like Dilbert, because everyone's just got like funky heads and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's Aaron is out of Portland, and they're very much a person who does zines and stuff like that. So this is their first published work through Top Shelf, and there will be a second issue on in April. And it's just really fun. It's a refreshing take. When I read a lot of superhero stuff, I get kind of burnt out because it's not really like my peanut butter and my jelly.
Right.
You know, it's like sometimes I'm a peanut butter, sometimes I'm jelly. And so when I read things like this that are very day-to-day sort of slice of life things, they tend to rejuvenate me. And this one was a pretty easy read, really clean artwork and really interesting. And it's LGBT, so of course it's going to fit into my wheelhouse of things that I like. So I very much look forward to reading a second issue because it's not very dense as far as reading is concerned. So it's just like, but I need more. So
cool. Yeah,
that's it.
Awesome. Thank you, Nicole. Yeah. Chris Cassell, what about you, sir?
I don't think I reviewed this one. It's the first issue of Savage from Valiant, written by B. Claymore and art by Clayton Henry and Louis LaRosa. And so for context, Valiant used to publish Turok Dinosaur Hunter. He was a guy who hunted dinosaurs. That's all you really need to know. But they don't.
Sold.
Yeah, they don't have the license to that anymore.
Because I was wondering if that's what this was. If this was their analog. For
this
Turok.
Is their analog for Turok.
Because once upon a time, they Valiant started out, and they were. But they had the Gold Key. They were revitalizing all the Gold Key kit. Magnus
Solar,
and Turok and Solar.
And the replacement for Solar is the Divinity title.
Got it. Okay,
so
cool.
They're not really working towards a Magnus. That's kind of covered with the Rai title. But so this is pretty much non-Turok Turok. And it's like, we want dinosaurs. We want a Khazar. And the setup is pretty... pretty basic, pretty well told. There's like a famous soccer player and his wife who handles the business stuff, and they're on a jet and it crashes and they land on Dinosaur Island. And so their baby is... So there's two sets of stories in each issue. The flashbacks to the family landing are drawn by Clayton Henry, who used to do The Incredible Hercules, really, really great stuff. Mm-hmm. And then the current day stuff starring the kid who's the Savage is drawn by Louis LaRosa, who does beautiful, beautiful work with dinosaurs.
Wow. Those are great dinosaurs.
Yeah, and they're really nice dinosaurs. Let me check that dinosaur out.
Yeah.
And
I'm gonna take that dinosaur home and make him part of my family.
My dinosaur now. so that we know the show's becoming that.
Yes.
And so you kind of the nice thing is I think they're gonna stay pretty good on schedule because it's split between the two artists. It's a really good set of timelines that they're telling. B. Clay Moore has a really good handle on pacing the story out. They also give you some nice backup features of like the construction of the art and the process work of Louis LaRosa. And yeah, it's fun. It's nothing too special to write home about. It's a savage guy fighting dinosaurs, you know. So if you just want dinosaurs, it's perfect. And if you want really nicely drawn dinosaurs, it's really perfect.
Cool. All right. Savage. Thanks, Chris. Cole Hornaday, what do you want to talk to us about?
Well, you know, I lived in fear of this day coming, and the day came when I screwed up on what I was going to do a book report on. And I figure we've managed to make it past 100 episodes, so I did pretty darn good.
Yeah, man.
But I'd originally planned, so Ben and I were talking about this off mic. I would like us to do an episode devoted to the comic books about bad guys that win.
Right.
Bad guys that take over the world. And one book that I thought was fairly successful at telling that kind of story was Mark Waid and Barry Kitson's Empire, which came out, over 10 years ago. Right?
Yeah.
And struggled because it originally was from an imprint that was Waid and...
It was like Kessel and Waid and somebody else. There was like three titles.
Busick.
Busick.
And it collapsed and it imploded or however you want to describe it. Yeah. But it took a long time to get Empire completed. And then there was a sequel through IDW called Empire Uprising. And because Mark Waid is infamous for, you know, dragging his heels and not getting things published, I just assumed that this story had never been finished. And I was going to review the first four issues of the sequel to Empire called Empire Uprising. Guess what? I'm wrong. There's like five more issues to that story that I haven't read, so I can't do that. So I'm just going to use... So I'm going to use my fallback of a comic book that's brought me the greatest amount of joy in 2016, and I'm looking forward to in 2017, and that is The Flintstones. So issue number 6 of The Flintstones does something that I thought was really, there's a moment in it. I highly recommend the book. This is a given, but you know, one of the things about the cartoon, and I grumped about how much I disliked the cartoon in the past, but one of the things that was funny about the cartoon were the little dinosaurs and the critters that were their household appliances that always had the cute little quips.
It's a living.
Well, we get to visit with some of their household items that are actually critters, like the armadillo that is Fred's bowling ball, and the little baby elephant that we know from the TV cartoon, who's the garbage or just the vacuum cleaner. We learn things from their perspective, like the armadillo being totally befuddled of why he's being kept in a bag, and why his master takes him out and throws him against these pieces of ivory down an alleyway. and then coming home and living in this bag again in the darkness. And then the vacuum cleaner is this little pink elephant, baby elephant, who lives, you know, in the closet next to the armadillo. And he says, and the little elephant says, I have no idea when I'll ever see daylight again. But do you know what keeps me going there in the dark? What, says the bowling ball armadillo, knowing that my friend bowling ball is on the other side of the door. It makes me think maybe the only meaning to life is that which we get from each other. And I'm like, oh my God, that is so sweet.
That's heartbreaking.
And it's lovely and it's heartbreaking. And I can't recommend this book enough. This is Flintstones number 6, written by, is it Jonathan Mark Russell, art by Steve Pugh. Pick it up. You're missing out.
Did you read the issues that you have thus far of mm-hmm. Empire Uprising?
Yeah, I did 1-4, but I don't know how the story ends.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I would like to devote an episode, if we can someday, about these kind of comics because...
We will. I've written it down.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah.
All right. Well, Flintstones, thank you, Cole. And that is Book Report. That is our show. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfectly Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything that Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, as well as Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Like all of our things on Facebook, just do simple searches. Go to our website to subscribe to us on iTunes or any way you get your podcast, Perfect Bound. podcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. Give us a book that you want us to review. Do you love Cross and you just want to tell Cole how much you love it? I'm sure he would love to read it.
Yeah, send come us, at me.
Send us questions because it's that time, friends. Put your quiz hats on. It's quiz time. This week, our questions come to us from Mr. Chris Cusso.
What?
So everything's Dr. Doom because of course.
Of course.
Because of course.
So first question is, according to the Mengo brothers, a pair of Latverian expatriate mercenaries who once hunted down the X-Men Gambit, what is the Latverian national motto?
It's the Valerian national motto.
Latverian national motto.
Live and let die.
Apparently, according to them, it's Curse Richards. Oh. Alternatively, officially online, it is We Master All That Lies Before, which I'm sure is the actual one. But
I was going to say Vanny Vidi Valerian.
Ooh,
nice.
Nice.
Well done. Next, I got Dr. Doom create an eclectic holiday that is celebrated whenever the ruler of Latveria, Dr. Doom, declares it. Thus, the exact date is variable. Apparently, the people of Latveria enjoy this holiday despite the fact that Doom has ordered them to. What is it called?
Doom Day.
Doomsday.
Oh, so close.
Yeah. Nice.
We'll give it to you.
Thank you.
The cosmic rays that gave the Fantastic Four their superpowers made the delivery of Susan and Reed's second child extremely difficult. And because Mr. Fantastic was caught up solving a world-threatening crisis, of course, the Human Torch had no choice but to call upon Victor Von Doom for help. Dr. Doom Dr. Doom used his vast intelligence and mystical capabilities to successfully deliver the baby. As the price for his help, Dr. Doom insisted that he be allowed to name the child. Mm-hmm. What was her name?
Valeria.
Yep. And Valeria. Who was she named after?
His mother.
No.
Oh.
The woman that he loved. The first woman he truly loved.
The one he stripped of her skin and wore it as armor.
Ironically, Dr. Doom would also eventually be the murderer of this woman. And also,
in all twisted ways.
Yeah, that's more wholesome than crossed, to be sure.
And also, Dr. Doom also planted a spell on the baby, making her his familiar spirit. And her first word ever spoken was Doom.
Oh, that's right.
So, nice. Okay, that her character's always fascinated me.
Yeah, because she loves her Uncle Doom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unky Doom.
Unky Doom. So, next is, at one point in the 70s, Kirby drew his interpretation of what Dr. Doom would look like under the mask, giving Dr. Doom only a tiny scar on his cheek. Mm-hmm. Due to this slight imperfection, Dr. Doom hides his face not from the world, but from himself. Mm. To Kirby, this is the motivation for Dr. Doom's vengeance against the world, because others are superior due to this slight scar, and he wants to elevate himself above them. But another writer introduced the concept that Doom was horribly, horribly disfigured under the mask. Which writer was this?
Mark Millar.
No. No. That was early on. That was back in the 70s, right? No?
Later.
Oh. I do not know.
John Byrne.
It was John Byrne. Yeah.
John Byrne introduced the idea that the accident only left Dr. Doom with the small scar that Kirby talked about, and he exaggerated disfigurement. But in his arrogance, he donned a newly forged face mask straight from the fire.
That's right.
Before
that's
it cooled, right. And he caused his own massive irreparably damaged face.
Right.
I can't talk tonight.
Man, yeah. Was he like sleep deprived? Because he's really smart.
He was just so excited. Like
he's very arrogant. Very arrogant. And he was.
He can defy temperature.
Yeah. Yes, seriously.
Reminds me of a funny joke. Anyway, go on.
Last question. In Fantastic Four number 350, Dr. Doom had been revealed to be a robot imposter, a Doombot, the entire time, and the real Dr. Doom, in a newly set of armor, returned to claim his country. According to this retcon, the last appearance of the real Dr. Doom was in the Battle of the Baxter Building way back in 1965's Fantastic Four number 60. Mm. Pretty big jump there. Who created this retcon?
That would probably be Mark Millar.
Walt Simonson.
Whoa.
He drew up a list of stories which featured the real Dr. Doom and those which did not. But later writers ignored this because screw it. And they retconned these story elements as an attempt by Doom to blame his own failures on unruly robots. So when in doubt, blame a Doombot.
When in doubt, blame a Doombot.
So I had no idea that Dr. Doom was a hipster. He wore the mask before it was cool.
Yeah. Oh.
Anyway,
minus 50 from Gryffindor.
Hey, I get that these days. All right. Thank you very much, Chris, for that quiz time. And thank you, friends, for another podcast. And thank you at home for listening. And we will see you next week.